This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and dispatch.com. Go to thedispatch.com to find out what was really inside the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Today we have a return, possibly the fastest turnaround for a return guest in the thousands of years that this podcast has been around. I'm excited to have him back. We're going to try and cover new ground, so be watchful for it. We have Matt Ridley, author of How Innovation Works. Did I say it correctly?
You did.
Okay. And delighted to have you back. How goes the book tour?
It's going great. And it's a real honor to be back on so quickly. Thank you so much. You may notice that I've cut my beard off since I was last on the show.
I've trimmed mine so you wouldn't feel like you're being interviewed twice by Ted Kaczynski. And also because the neighborhood children were starting to pedal away really fast when they saw me emerge from my house. So, listeners who heard this last time know that you have this book about how innovation works, where innovation comes from. You're the guy who came up with this idea that ideas have sex, and that's how they spread around and create new things. We're going to talk about all that. But I wanted to sort of skip ahead just for 2 seconds. In the book, you write about how Peter Thiel said that the reason why the computer world got so advanced, or the internet world got so advanced, is that we what's the phrase? We regulate atoms, but we don't regulate data. Was that
correct? Yeah, basically, yeah. We're very permissive about innovation in bits. You know, if you want to set up a startup doing something online, digital, you know, a new website or something, there's very few permits you need to get. And right. That's the result of a specific piece of very permissive legislation that the Clinton administration brought in the 1990s, which sort of basically unleashed e-commerce. It's a very nice example of government doing something that actually does encourage innovation. But he compares that with, you know, if you want to invent a new drug or a new medical device or something like that, you have to get an enormous amount of permission. It costs you an enormous amount of money. And more importantly, it costs you an enormous amount of time. And so he's saying that we are redirecting the energies of entrepreneurs towards digital innovation rather than physical innovation. And that may be a problem in the long run.
Right. So I wanted to ask you if you've heard this story. Do you know who John Nestor was?
Oh, I've heard the name, but no, I can't remember.
Yeah, so he gave rise to the phrase nestoring. And so the story goes, you had to have heard this at some point, but listeners will like it. At one point, DC area traffic experts couldn't figure out why traffic was slowing down as much as it was at a certain time of day, every single day during the work week. And they figured out that there was one person who was just driving at the speed limit in the left lane every day at rush hour, and it screwed up everything. Because in, you know, here in America, the left lane's for the passing lane, you go fast. And he ended, so Nestor ended up writing a letter to the editor, to the Washington Post, after the story came out. And he said, yeah, it's me. Why? And he says, why should I inconvenience myself for someone who wants to speed? The left lane is quicker. I'm going the legal limit. There's no problem. Now, the beauty of this is that Nestor turned out to be a regulator at the Food and Drug Administration. And he had the exact same attitude, if not worse, about permitting new drugs and whatnot. And he actually was transferred out of his division because he had approved no new chemical entities from 1968 to 1972. And he basically wouldn't approve anything, and he did everything as slowly as possible and all the rest, which made him a hero to Ralph Nader and all those groups that, you know, he protected us from the evils of innovation and all of these kinds of things. Right. And so the first question is how do you prevent nestering in a large bureaucratic state operation? And then I have some follow-up questions.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a big issue. And I've just written an article recently that directed at the British government saying one thing you need to look at if you want to unleash growth and innovation after this epidemic is to speed up bureaucratic decisions. Right. And I make the case in that article that it's not that bureaucrats say no to things, it's that they take an age to say yes. That's the real problem. I've got a lovely tiny little example of this myself, which is there's a river near here where I have a little bit of fishing rights, and there's other angling clubs that have fishing rights to the salmon that run up this river. And there was an old fish pass that enabled the fish to get past a dam on one bank of the river, but it had been closed years ago because people kept poaching it. And there's another fish pass on the other bank, but it doesn't really work because it goes through a waterworks. So the question was, can we reopen this old fish pass? And we asked the water company, and they said, go ahead, no problem for us. So we asked the Environment Agency, which regulates rivers, you wouldn't mind if we just reopened this fish pass, would you? It'd just take a matter of digging it out and letting the water flow through it. And they said, oh, wait a second, that'll have to go to our water abstraction committee. We said, we're not abstracting the water, we're just taking it out and putting it back in again about 10 yards further downstream, you know, and it's only a 10% of the water or something. No, it's still got to go to that committee. Well, you know, how do we apply to that committee? Well, it only meets twice a year. Right. Okay. And its next meeting's not till June, you know, that kind of thing. And the Water Abstraction Committee eventually came back and said, actually, you know what? You're putting the water back in, so it's no problem. It's not for us. It doesn't come under our jurisdiction. You shouldn't have come to us. We said, right, that's what we said at the first time. Can we now have permission? And they said, well, let's talk to our fish pass committee. Oh, you mean you have one of those? You know, et cetera. Fish pass committee took another 3 months and said, oh, do you know what? In the end, we can't think of a reason to say no. So we said, is that a yes? And they said, well, temporary. Yeah, do it for a week or two and we'll see if it works. So, you know, go ahead, make a plan to do it. So I called up the angling club and I said, Saturday afternoon, I'll bring the sandwiches, somebody bring a digger, everyone else bring a spade and a pickaxe. We got down there, 4 hours, we did it. We had water flowing through. And as we walked away, the sea trout were starting to run up. You could see them skittling through the pass. And then I got a call from the Environment Agency saying, have you come up with your plan for opening the fish pass yet? I said, well, we did it on Saturday. And they said, what? Well, we've opened it. It's working. What? Well, we thought it was a £1 million project. We thought you were going to have to raise the money. And I said, well, if you'd been doing it, it would have been a £1 million project.
Right.
Now, I mean, sorry, this is a trivial example and it's not.
No, I love this kind of stuff. Yeah.
But the degree to which public bureaucracies particularly, but sometimes private ones too, are actually rewarded by delaying things, by not taking decisions. You know, if you don't take the decision, maybe you can pass it on to your successor and you're not responsible. If you do take the decision, suddenly you're in the frame if it goes wrong.
Right.
Whereas the entrepreneur, it's the exact opposite incentive. The longer it takes to take the decision, the more problem he has getting money off his investors or whatever.
And yeah, my, I'm sorry, go on. Go
it's on. Something like 2 to 5 years to get a new medical device approved in most countries in the world. It's quicker in the US than it is in Europe, but it's still a long time. And that's too long for most entrepreneurs. And as a result, they didn't invent point of care rapid diagnostic DNA tests for viruses right. over the last 10 years, for example. You know, we don't know that for sure, but we can be pretty well certain that, that there's an awful lot of unseen stuff never got done because of the slowness of bureaucratic decisions. And of course, this is where China scores, because if you want to, I mean, my wife was in China just before Wuhan blew up, and she didn't go to Wuhan, thankfully, but last fall she was in China and she was visiting research labs. And she talked to somebody who had had an idea for a new kind of experiment in his university lab and had literally built the lab and done it in about a month, whereas she'd have had to apply for
sure.
you know, all sorts of permits and research grants and so on. So she said that's why they're able to do so much, is because the speed at which they can take decisions.
Yeah, so one quick anecdote, and then I have a question for that. My dad was in the military in Japan shortly after World War II, around the time of the Korean War. And he had some fascinating stories. You would have loved to ask him about it, because his job was to take, was a survey taker for post-World War II industrial growth in Japan. And he went to all these little companies like Sony, you know, and asked them questions, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, his commanding officer... His commanding officer was black, was African American, which, you know, this had to be within a year of desegregation of the army. To have a black commanding officer was really sort of unusual, and so he was clearly a good bureaucratic political player. And he once said to my dad, "Goldberg, it is always better to be on the committee that says this must never happen again." And, and for a bureaucratic mindset, that's actually kind of brilliant, right? Is you're never responsible for the mistake, but you get to come in and criticize the people who made it. Anyway, so the reason why I brought up the Peter Thiel thing and the you know, data, not atoms stuff and all that is that philosophically, I agree with you about the need for innovation, and government should get out of the way of innovation. I'm a pretty passionate believer that, you know, we don't get modern society without, you know, the Deirdre McCloskey argument that mm-hmm. the change in attitudes towards innovation. And I know you have some disagreements with her, but but your disagreements are sort of second order, and just that
absolutely
you have a which came first thing, right?
She's a leading genius in this area, yeah.
But so the question I have, though, is if China has a much more open and congenial environment for innovation, how come they're not inventing jetpacks either, right? I mean, how come their stuff is still, as far as I can tell, lab innovation and not cool new super fast spaceships and jetpacks, because I want jetpacks. That's what I've wanted for a long time now. So, I mean, you see what I'm saying? Is that
yeah,
if,
it's a really
I'm wondering
good
if there's
question.
Another if there's another limit to the material, physical, the big machine inventions that we haven't seen for a long time, other than just the regulatory environment.
Yes, and I think there is. And I mean, I write in my book, and I may have talked to you about this before in the previous episode, about how we had this incredible burst of transport innovations in the first half of the 20th century and an incredible burst of communication innovations in the second half of the 20th century. And I don't believe that that switchover was because government suddenly made it much harder to develop innovations in transport. Mm-hmm. We ran up against some kind of limits. You know, efficiency of a jet plane flying at twice the speed of sound is very low. It burns a hell of a lot more fuel, etc. So it just doesn't make sense to do commercial flights at supersonic speeds unless you can hop into space, and that's a step too far for most technologies, and that kind of thing. And I suspect something similar applies to the personal jetpack. I mean, I can point you to areas which have been starved of innovation because of rules and regs, nuclear being a very good example, that we wrote the rules and regs in such a way that you have to pre-specify your design in enormous detail in advance, which of course prevents you from trying anything new. You take 8 years and $100 million to get through the regulatory process. You're not going to say, and by the way, here's a new screw we're going to try towards the end of building the power plant. So that cuts you off from novelty. The question is China developing the sorts of new materials, new devices, new power plants, etc., that its system will allow it to do? And that'll be a very interesting question, because you're quite right. So far, the way China has become an innovation engine for the world has been by developing, you know, WeChat and Alibaba and all this kind of thing. In other words, it's just simply done the whole digital thing even better than we've been doing in the West. I suspect that may be changing. I suspect the issue is partly that China was in catch up for a long time. It was simply emulating our technologies, and it wasn't trying to bust through into new technologies. But if it were to do thorium reactors, molten salt reactors, molten metal reactors, fusion reactors, if it were to get some of those going in the power plant area, then it might start to do much more atom innovation and much less bit innovation than we're doing. But you're right, it's a slight corrective to the Peter Thiel view of the world to note that China doesn't seem to be able to invent personal jetpacks either. And it'll be interesting to see whether they do in the years ahead. So I guess my answer is like Cho in Lies about the French Revolution. It's too early to tell.
Although I've used that for years, and then somebody said he may not have said it. It was a bad translation. So just forewarned. But I love the Chow and Lai thing.
Thank you. That's helpful.
So one of the things that I really like about the book and your argument is, and we talked about this a bit last time, is that innovation is more important than invention, because there's a very Hayekian thing going on here, right? And that there's that the innovator doesn't actually necessarily need to know how all the inventions work. He or she just needs to know how to put new elements together in innovative ways that bring a better product or a greater efficiency or whatever to bear. It's sort of like the Jeff Goldblum character from The Fly, who invents a teleportation device, and he says, look, I'm really basically just a systems manager. I don't know how most of this stuff works. I just go ask people to invent certain things, and I put it all together and do this. Of course, then he turns into a giant fly, which is a problem. But
it's quite a big problem.
Except for that, Mrs. Lincoln, you know, it's a great invention. So one of the questions I had is, you know, so part of that is tinkering, right? Is that you're a big believer in tinkering and sort of just playing with the stuff.
Actually, just before you go on to that point, Jonah, because I think you've said something rather interesting there that hadn't quite occurred to me before. When I'm making the distinction between the inventor and the innovator, I'm mainly talking about the innovator being the person who drives down the price, drives up the reliability, drives up the availability of something. But I hadn't quite thought of it in terms of the innovator really doesn't need to know how it works. The inventor maybe does need to know how it works. I think that's quite an interesting insight, which I don't think I've had.
It's a very eye pencil point, right?
Yes, I mean, it is, absolutely. And eye pencil is my Bible. Great essay. But I think it's a nice point that the first prototype is built by someone who really does understand the physics behind the thing.
Right.
Whereas the guys who turn it into something useful just know it as a black box, what goes in, what comes out. Thank you for that.
Oh, sure. I will collect my royalty and in beers in England in one day. But so the thing I've been thinking about is perhaps one of the artificial temporary limits that doesn't have to do with regulation per se, is that it is just much more difficult to be your sort of classic Renaissance man today. You know, when Da Vinci did stuff, he, you know, his medical drawings, his engineering drawings, there was an ability for the human brain to hold in its head the current state of knowledge in a whole bunch of different fields. Mm-hmm. Ben Franklin, you know, Thomas Jefferson, you know, they were essayists and engineers at the same time. And it kind of feels to me, who's not smart enough in any field, that the complexity of these things makes that kind of jack of all trades, master of none tinkering much more difficult. Could that be part of the limit to why we don't have JPEGs?
Yes, I think that is an issue. Too much specialization. There was a biography a few years ago of a British scientist, I guess you'd call him, from around 1800, whose name I think was Thomas Young. But the title of the book was The Last Man Who Knew Everything, which is a really nice title. And I can't quite remember what it is that Thomas Young did or invented or discovered that shows how he knew everything. But I think it was something to do with being both a brilliant archaeologist and a brilliant engineer and a very good physicist or something like that. Young's slits may be named after him, if you remember them, in diffraction theory and physics. Okay, but the point that I can't quite remember what he did slightly makes the point, doesn't it? That already yeah. it was too late to do that kind of thing. You know, that the ability to see everything was slipping away. I mean, Leonardo is such a sort of standout person that he looks exceptional even in his own era, I suspect. But it surely is true that, I mean, every now and then you meet somebody who has a Jared Diamond is quite a nice example, a very, very fine writer who also discovered new bird species or rediscovered them in New Guinea and wrote very interesting articles about the ecology of New Guinea. But his day job was physiology for most of his career. You know, it was in a lab somewhere. I mean, these are extraordinary achievements for anyone, and he combined three careers. But I suspect it got too much for him in the end, and I think he gave up the day job finally.
Yeah, I mean, if I had a lab day job and I wrote several international bestsellers, I might go the same way. But the reason why I find this kind of worrisome, I mean, how to put this, I remember when Charles Murray came out with his book, Human Accomplishment, I went to a dinner to celebrate it, and the conversation with Irving Kristol, Charles Krauthammer, and a bunch of people that I had no business being at the same table with, basically turn to the fact that it's going to be very difficult to have many Nobel Prize winning ideas go to the developed world, coming from the developed world, simply because the state of science is at a place where you can't have one guy with a legal pad and a pencil coming up with some new theorem that changes the world anymore. You need superconducting super colliders and all of these very expensive things, and it's so much more collaborative than it used to be that individual genius can't break through the noise. And it feels like if that's true, I mean, there are all sorts of interesting political consequences that come from that, but there's also just the sense that we may be at a plateau for the kind of non-digital innovation or non-medical innovation, because I think playing with genes is sort of the same principle. For a good long while.
Yeah, I think that may be true, but I suspect we're underestimating the degree to which that was true in the past. So if you go back to, 18th century London or 16th century Italy or 17th century Holland, you would find in that place that the people who were doing the incredible discovering and inventing were unbelievably well-networked. They were talking to lots of other clever people. They were corresponding overseas, et cetera, et cetera. And if you weren't in one of those places, you would say, it's just no good. I just can't get the access to the kind of network that I need, the Royal Society of London or whatever it might be, to be able to develop stuff. Because it's always been true that innovation hasn't been a global phenomenon, that it's been very localized at any one time. You know, whether it's Song China 1,000 years ago, or the Arabian Empire a little bit before that, or the Indian stuff, in 500 BC, or the ancient Greece in between those two times, there's always been one part of the world that's been the main motor of innovation. And it's a surprisingly small part of the world. Arguably, it's a bay on the west coast of America for the last 50 years. You know, that's mm-hmm. a pretty amazing thought when you think about it. Of course, that's exaggerating. You know, other places sure. achieve things too. But that implies that there's always been a barrier to doing this stuff if you're not part of the key network where the ideas are being shared. And the thoughts or just go back 100 years to a story I do write about in the book, which is Fritz Haber and Otto Bosch inventing the nitrogen fixation process that gave us fertilizers, but also gave us explosives. And that is a long piece of hard grind industrial development rather than research. Once they got the idea. That is incredibly difficult because they've got to do these reactions at enormously high pressures and enormously high temperatures, and none of the materials they have can cope with it. But the reason they can crack the problem is because they're sitting right next to some of the most advanced steel makers in the world and some of the most advanced armament makers, etc. So they're drawing upon a network of German industries around 1910 that other people don't have. And so you'd say then, the time has gone when a talented individual amateur can make a difference. This is the future. It's hundreds and hundreds of German people in a giant factory doing thousands of experiments with enormous amounts of money. This was probably, by the way, the biggest industrial research project before the Manhattan Project, and so on. So I think it's been true for a longer time than we think.
Yeah,
that the individual hasn't been able to make much of a contribution. And of course, part of my argument is that this is always a much more collaborative process than we recognize.
And I guess you could make the case that in a world that is now so connected digitally, you know, where you can be in on conversations from 10,000 miles away through YouTube and whatever, that you actually are networking more people than ever before, just in a different way than we traditionally conceive of it.
Yes, I do think that's the case. And you do hear about, somebody in Shanghai having a conversation with someone in San Francisco and quite quickly going into production. And after all, a lot of the digital stuff that's come about in recent years hasn't required that much capital. It hasn't actually been that big a project. You know, I mean, the invention of Facebook didn't really need anything other than a garage and a few friends. And so you can make the case that we've actually gone back a bit to the talented individual making a difference today because of the network effect. Just back to the point, though, about whether or not you can get sort of polymathic contributors. There's a very nice little thing that I've dug up recently, that there's a site called Innocentive where big firms or other organizations can post a problem on a website and invite solutions from people. And there's a way of sharing the rewards if the solution turns out to be a good one. And a study of that site has found that most of the solutions came from unexpected fields. They didn't come from people who are already within the field, which is very nice. That's telling us the serendipity point about innovation.
Yeah.
But it does slightly imply that that's what we may be missing in most of the innovation departments of big firms and so on, is that you haven't got the chance for the linguist to have a conversation with the engineer or something weird like that. And I often, you know, my favorite example of ideas having sex is the invention of the pill camera, which is a pill that you take with an electronic camera inside. And it came about, I don't think it's been a very successful invention, but it was quite a neat idea. It came about after a conversation over a garden fence between a gastroenterologist and a guided missile designer. That's a lovely example, I think, of these two things coming together.
Yeah, I once talked to an engineer who said that the field was being done enormous harm by the emphasis on formal test taking and the sort of rigid kind of stuff that elite schools want. He said it used to be that you could some weird quirky kid could get into one of these places by just showing, hey, look, I invented this thing or whatever. And you would get stranger people. It's also like if you look at the public intellectual, a lot of the public intellectuals that are sort of my guiding lights in sort of in conservative affairs, they got their PhDs just by writing a book and submitted it. And, you know, they didn't. And the meritocracy creates the kinds of people that are really good at doing the things the bureaucracy wants them to do, which is different than actually being creative thinkers. I mean, should we have, for example, just a huge number of prizes for cool inventions? You know, Napoleon gets us canned goods by just saying, you know, come up with something and, you know, I'll give you 12,000 francs to do it. Shouldn't we just, and there's longitude and all that. Wouldn't it be, what is that one way we can just sort of bypass the gatekeeper problem, the nestering problem?
Absolutely. You can also bypass the intellectual property problem there, which is, I think, a huge problem, the degree to which patents and copyrights are actually hindrances to innovations. They're toll booths, they're patent thickets, they're trolls, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think that's a much bigger problem than we've appreciated. And there's a very smart young man called Anton Howes, who's just recently been the historian at the Royal Society of Arts, which is the sort of pro-technology society that's been bubbling along in London for 500 years or something. And arts, you know, sounds like art, but actually it means manufacturing. And he's just come out with a very nice essay saying we really should be using prizes more. And what I hadn't realized is that people have become smart about how the prize would work. Michael Kramer, the recent Nobel Prize winner at MIT, has actually developed some of this idea, where you don't just give a lump sum to somebody who invents a vaccine. You know, you say, if anyone can invent a vaccine for pneumococcus, which is killing kids in the developing world at a high rate, we'll give you millions and millions of dollars. Well, the problem with that is they might pocket the money and then not sell the vaccine or sell the vaccine at such a price that nobody can afford it. So what you do instead, and this is exactly what the Gates Foundation did in that very case, is you say, we'll give you an enormous reward if you invent this thing, but it will be in the form of a contract to manufacture and distribute them. It's just that we'll subsidize the price at which you can sell them. So that you can sell them cheaply, but you will actually make quite a lot of money out of doing it. And that resulted in three winners, apparently, all of whom produced effective vaccines against this disease. And it is, they reckon by now it's saved 700,000 lives, which is quite a lot. So yes, prizes, I think we need to think about them much more carefully. I wasn't convinced of this until recently because I worried about the problem that a prize is just going to be gamed, you know, all the cronies are going to get together and make sure they give the prize to each other. And soon, before you know where you are, it's not going to be going to a practical invention. It's going to be going to some esoteric thing done in a university where the chums of the people giving the award work. But actually, I think if it's well designed and if it's in these kind of forms of advanced market contracts, then I think it can actually do a lot of good. And it could go alongside buying out patents. That's another way in which government could spend money on innovation that would be quite effective. The patent on a lot of the key technologies behind 3D printing has recently expired, about 4 years ago. And the consequence has been a dramatic drop in the price of 3D printing and a great flourishing of new applications and ideas in 3D printing. The same happened with Watt's steam engine patents when they expired. And the French government, as long ago as the 1830s, actually bought out Louis Daguerre's patent on photography so as to make sure that everybody had a go at it. And so I think both prizes and the buying out of patents are quite smart ways for governments to encourage innovation and encourage it in an area where they know they want it to happen, but not get into the habit of picking winners and thereby picking losers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on the patent stuff. My only concern about, you know, you raised the concern about cronies rewarding each other on the prizes side. My understanding, and obviously you know this far better than I do, that the big problem with patents is that people basically take out micro patents that are related to all sorts of manufacturing, and then they get scooped up and bundled, and they're used as extortion to keep companies from improving their products without paying exorbitant royalties. Couldn't you have the same problem if the government's buying them up? I mean, you still have people taking out these stupid patents on these things and saying, okay, now the government's going to pay. Instead of extorting some private sector guy, I'm going to extort the government. It's still sort of the same problem, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, actually. And again, Michael Kramer's thought about that and thought about ways in which the price of buying out patents could be set in such a way that the government being in the market to buy them out doesn't automatically result in people gaming the system and, you know, applying for frivolous patents in the hope of being bought out. No, I think probably the most meaningful reform to the patent system is, and Alex Tabarrok thinks about this quite a lot, is to start splitting, instead of it being so monolithic, you know, you get one long patent or nothing. You know, we want 2-year patents, 5-year patents, 10-year patents, 20-year patents, and the 20-year patents are really hard to get and, you know, only given out in exceptional circumstances. So as to just give a little bit of a reward. Well, just to reform the system, you know, because if you went cold turkey from a patent system to a non-patent system, it would probably be very difficult. But if you could just start to blur the distinction, because there are, you know, most of the software industry doesn't bother with patents. I mean, by the time you've started to get royalties in from the patent you've taken out on a piece of software, somebody's written another piece that goes around it anyway, so it's worthless. Right. So they don't even try. They just say the important thing is to be first into the new development, which is one of the reasons why software moves so much faster than hardware.
All right, so I want to. So, just a little background. I really liked talking to you last time, and the thing that sort of drove me crazy is I didn't ask you about this thing that the physicist Richard Feynman had come up with about, and I wrote about it recently for the site. We'll put the link in the show notes, and. Basically, what happened was when Richard Feynman, who was the famous physicist, he was at Caltech, and Caltech was worried that they weren't getting enough kids majoring in physics, and so they asked Feynman to reinvent the curriculum, and he gave this very famous lecture where he said, you know, think about a world in which there's been some horrible cataclysm, and humanity's basically been wiped out, and some other species or people our beings, whatever, take our place and they have to start over from zero. And you can only leave them one sentence, one snippet survives from our civilization that would help them become more, that would help them save time advancing. And the reason I bring this up is I listened to this horrible episode of Radiolab, a show that I actually like, because they basically went around and asked a whole bunch of different people what their one sentence was. And with very few exceptions, it sounded like they had just walked down the hall of a community college HR department and asked a bunch of, you know, and there just happened to be a meeting of these sort of post, you know, the postmodernists and the feminists and a few diversity officers. And it was just horrible. And I really wanted to know what, like, an engineer might say, or a biologist, or a theologian. I mean, there are all sorts of people that I would love to hear from that would offer their one snippet. And when I concluded the last time Matt was on, I said, oh my God, one of the people I would really love to hear from is you. So I sent you the Feynman hypothesis thing, and you said you would be happy to talk about it. So what would be your one snippet that you would pass on to a future generation?
Yeah, well, just a couple of thoughts before I give you my answer. Robert Heinlein wrote a story about an advanced extraterrestrial civilization that blows up a planet just for fun and then suddenly realizes there might have been living creatures on it. And they go down and they search through the dust and they only find one thing and they take it home. And it turns out to be a can of film, you know, a movie. And They think the creatures that lived on this planet had really interesting capabilities of bending the laws of physics, and there's only a few words on the film which they never translate at the end, and the words are a Walt Disney production. So they're watching Mickey Mouse, basically, or Tom and Jerry, or something like that. it's quite a nice sort of way of thinking about it. I think my answer is, well, I've thought about this, and I would like three answers, but you're not going to let me have three answers.
No, you go anywhere you want with this. I'm just very interested to hear what you have to say about all of it. So I won't hold you to anything.
On the one hand, I would like to say evolution by natural selection, the idea of bottom-up spontaneous order, the idea of emerging complexity from nothing. The idea that all you need is variation and selection, and you get order. And in a sense, this is one of the few ideas that sort of petered through from a previous civilization that was destroyed, because this is exactly what Lucretius writes about rather beautifully in his poem De Rerum Natura, around the time of Cicero and Caesar, and which gets suppressed by the Christian civilization that comes along afterwards, every copy burned until they, many, many centuries later, one is found in a German monastery and is gradually pieced together. And this becomes an incredibly influential essay on the Enlightenment. People like Thomas Jefferson had, I can't remember how many copies of this essay in different translations, etc. You know, they were just an example of a very important insight. Okay. But then I can't leave out the double helix and genetic code. The fact that at the heart of all life is a linear digital code, a simple piece of information. That's the difference between living things and non-living things. I would love to tell future civilizations about that. So I think what I'm going to do is combine those two ideas together with a third one, and say that what I would really like to tell whoever finds this remnant of our civilization is that life, living things, and technology, the things we make, are all in the same business. And that business is making order out of disorder, making improbable but useful structures. And in order to do so, calling upon supplies of energy. And the more energy you call upon, the more improbability and complexity you can produce. that explains evolution. It sort of explains genetics, and it actually takes in engineering and technology too. It's quite a long sentence, that, and I apologize for that, but it was
okay.
That would be my answer. So the second law of thermodynamics and how life and technology get round it.
Yeah. No, well, and that makes sense. I mean, that's how your book begins, with the second law of thermodynamics, which I find Steven Pinker once wrote. There's a website called Verge. I think it's called Verge. And they went around asking.
The Edge.
Oh, The Edge. That's what it is. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sometimes I'm not actually dyslexic when I read, but I am dyslexic about the things I remember. And
I don't think that was dyslexic. That was associational.
Perhaps it was. But they ask a bunch of different experts, what's the one idea you wish people understood more, which is sort of similar to the Feynman thing?
Yeah.
And he did a wonderful one on the second law of thermodynamics, and which I think has much more bearing on, I mean, it's sort of a sub-theme of my most recent book, is that you know, the civilization that we have around us is essentially unnatural, and so it takes work to keep it going,
yeah,
right? Because exactly. Otherwise it wants, exactly. You know, nature wants to claw it back. And yeah. And anyway, I think it would help people a great deal to think more about, you know, how the second law of thermodynamics applies to all sorts of things outside of just science, you know, yeah. Or a science test.
John Tooby and Leda Cosmides wrote an essay once that the title of which was "The Second Law of Thermodynamics is the First Law of Psychology." I think it was making a similar point to the one you just made.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Tooby did a essay in that series that was also hugely influential on me about the coalition instinct, which is this thing that explains right. Why groups are, it can be internally inconsistent and not and be blind to it, because once you're part of the in-group, you can see the hypocrisy or the inconsistencies of other groups, but you become numb to it in your own group. And I think that explains a lot of our politics these days. But
it certainly does. It certainly does. Yeah.
So I was just wondering, one last train of thought. What do you make of this stuff that Andrew McAfee writes about, our mutual friend Ron Bailey has written about the dematerialization of our economies? We're basically just, for the first time in all of human history, economic output has been sort of essentially decoupled from resource allocation, which is kind of amazing. We're the physical weight of our economy is shrinking, not growing, even though we're getting richer. What do you make about all of that? And is that perhaps another example of why it's maybe a good thing that we've hit a sort of a plateau on the transportation and heavy equipment innovation stuff, or not?
Actually, yeah, that last point I hadn't thought of, but I think that the more from less stuff is great. I think it's really mm-hmm. interesting, very important, and it's a huge answer to the line that you often hear from environmentalists and that gets a cheer whenever they say it, which is you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. Or it cannot have infinite growth with finite resources. Well, yes, you can, if growth means using fewer resources to achieve the same ends. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that. We're using 13% as much aluminum in a drinks can as we did 20 years ago. We're using less steel per building, less steel per car, less water per crop plant in agriculture, less land per food, per quantity of food, dramatically so, 68% less land to produce a given quantity of food compared with 50 years ago, you know, enormous improvements. And until recently, those reductions were absorbed in the fact that we then went out and used more stuff anyway. And this is known as Jevons's paradox, that if you make electricity cheaper, people leave the lights on. Mm-hmm. As it were,
right.
You know, you just become less frugal in your use of it. So you end up using more anyway. And that was true for a lot of things. But if you think about the LED light that has replaced the incandescent bulb, and which on average uses about 20% as much electricity, that means I've got to leave my lights on five times as long in my mm-hmm. house, I think, or was it four times as long? My arithmetic's not very good here. thank you, Nick, at five, I think, in order to be using more electricity than I was in the past. Now, I'm easily liable to leave it on 1.5 times or twice as long, but I don't think I'm ever going to leave it on 5 times as long. That's one of the reasons electricity demand actually has gone up a lot slower than people thought, because the demand for lighting is shrinking quite fast. So actually, I think we have at last got past the Jevons paradox and into real gross, into real net savings rather than just gross ones. McAfee has written about this brilliantly, and I think it's a really interesting insight. And I hadn't heard. I mean, I do mention it in my book, but I hadn't heard about the fact that we are not just using less stuff per head in the American economy and the British economy now, but that we're using less stuff overall in those economies. Now, you've got to take into account that we've exported some of the stuff making to China, but I think you can. I think that is taken into account in these calculations.
Yeah, now McAfee at least says, and I have no reason to doubt him, that he takes into account in the drop-off of a lot of commodities, including trade, including the fact that, you know, this stuff comes from another place and all of that, which is just, it's just an amazing thing. So you wrote Rational Optimist. I used to work for a guy named Ben Wattenberg. I used to know Julian Simon a good deal. And this whole dematerialization thing is sort of chapter 7 of his famous bet with Paul Ehrlich about whether the prices of commodities would go down
over my left shoulder is the Julian Simon Award made of the five metals in the bet, which I'm very
proud
of.
Oh, is that right? That's awesome. And actually, Julian Simon was a great example of what we were talking about earlier. You mentioned Jared Diamond. I mean, Julian Simon was a direct mail, not a mail marketing guy or something like right?
Yeah, you're right. There was something like that. Yes.
And then he was just sort of became this resource economist. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, all the elite types all hated him, is because he was just this sort of interloper from, you know, the non-rarefied world of higher education.
From
the real world, yeah. Make the case for some, I'm sure you get asked this constantly, make the case for some optimism during these fairly gloomy times. Particularly, I always tell people I basically have the Matt Ridley position on climate change. So if you could also include that in reasons for optimism, that would be helpful, because I recently did some stuff on eschatology. That is, for a lot of people, the key driver of the end times is the climate change stuff.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's 10 years since The Rational Optimist came out. I've been around the world talking about it in that time pretty well every year. And every year there's always been a reason for somebody to say, you surely can't still be optimistic after what's happened this year, whether it was the great financial crisis, the euro crisis, the Ukraine war, the Syria war, some aspect of climate change that had hit the news, droughts, floods, something happening in the world. Every year there's been a reason to say you must be wrong now. You've got to admit it's getting worse. And this one's a big one, the pandemic. But it's even at its worst, it's not going to wipe out a significant percentage of the population like the 1918 flu did. It's not going to it may do huge damage to politics and to economics, and it may throw a lot of people out of work, but it's not going to in itself undermine the process by which we create wealth. Now, how we put that process back together again is an issue, but I see no reason why that is going to prevent us. I've just been looking very hard at the 1890 Russian flu pandemic, which very few people know about. But the reason it's interesting is it might have been a coronavirus, we now think, one which we now have and which circulates in our societies as the commonest of the common colds that's caused by coronavirus. But it was pretty nasty when it first arrived, and the genetic evidence suggests it first arrived in our species in 1890, which is when there was this terrible pandemic. And that killed, you know, a lot of people. It killed 1 million people, which was more than this has killed, and a hugely greater proportion of the world population than this has killed. Do you think of the 1890 as the beginning of the end of the world? No, you think of it as the beginning of the beginning of the world. And likewise, I think this century will see us go on to great strides. What about climate change? Yes, it's a real issue. Yes, climate is changing. Yes, we're responsible. Yes, it's possible that it will be pretty disastrous. But if you look at the actual prognostications based on realistic assessments of the sensitivity of the climate to carbon, realistic estimates of what we're going to do to our energy uses, not to extreme scenarios, and you ignore the sort of ludicrous exaggerations that's coming out from Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg and people like that, you know, if you look at what the scientists are actually saying, then you end up saying it might prevent some of the enrichment that is inevitably coming our way. The numbers, just to put it at its most basic, are that the worst that can happen is that instead of being 450% richer on average in 2100, we will be 430% richer in 2100. Now, that's a big difference, but it's not exactly misery for everyone, let alone extinction and cannibalism, which is what I had to put up with when last time I debated an activist on the radio about this, who said within 10 years we'll all be eating each other. You know, that doesn't spring out of any scientific scenario, you see. So, and if we don't get 430% richer, then we're not going to produce enough carbon dioxide to create the warming. So, you know, they've got a chicken and egg problem here. They're saying we're going to get so much richer that we're going to create much carbon dioxide, which is going to damage our civilization and the planet itself. Now, there's a lot of other things we should be worried about, like coral reefs and ice caps along the way. But again, we are seeing warming happening much slower than predicted in 1990 when this whole thing began. Because we were then told, and the word used was predict, it wasn't just a scenario, that we would see 0.3 degrees of warming per decade, 0.3 degrees centigrade per decade going forward. Well, we've now had 30 of those years. We've had three of those decades. The average so far, if you take the surface temperature data, is about 0.15 per decade, so half as much. Mm-hmm. And if you take the satellite data, it's even less. It's 0.12. That's even below the range we were told it was going to be in 1990. We were told it would be 0.2 to 0.5 with a best estimate of 0.3 per decade. It's been much less than that. Now, they can say, well, it's going to accelerate shortly, but so far there's no evidence of that. So I'm pretty persuaded that when I come back on your show, age 92 in 2050, that I will be able to say, what was all the fuss about climate change? Yes, climate has continued to change, but A, it wasn't as bad as we thought, and B, we've cracked it with new technologies. We're using so much fusion power and natural gas that we don't use coal anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my climate. No,
that was great. I mean, I personally am a fan of more innovation in geoengineering, that, you know, that we should come up with some break glass in case of emergency ways of using a different kind of man-made climate change to cool the planet if we need to, whether it's particles released in the stratosphere or whatever. You know, I do worry about the oceans.
Being a biologist, I like the idea of greening the Sahara or fertilizing the ocean better than this physics stuff in space. I'm a little bit worried about putting umbrellas in between us and the sun. I think that could go wrong.
No, I'm with you. I'd like to think about it, you know. I'd like to learn more about it. And but I love the fertilizing the ocean stuff. I think that's really fascinating. I have so many more things we could talk to you about, but I know you have got another schlep to a different chair for a different book tour interview. Thank you so much for coming back, and I hope to have you on before 2050 when you're 92.
Jonah, thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
Okay, so Matt is gone. And I didn't get to repeat the name of his book. It's How Innovation Works. I should actually give you the whole thing. It's How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom. And as you can tell, I am still kind of a fanboy about Matt Ridley. I was very excited to see. You guys can't see because you're not blind, but you're just listening to a podcast. In the bookshelf behind him, where I could see a copy of my first book sitting there, which was kind of cool. Sort of like Scott Immergood, our friend from Ricochet, who's the producer of the Glob podcast. He once sent me a picture from Tom Wolfe's house where he had a dog-eared copy of Liberal Fascism sitting on his desk, which I thought was pretty cool. So anyway, there was other stuff I would love to have talked to him about, but he had to go. If you follow him on Twitter, you'll see he's been doing just an incredible run of podcast and virtual appearances for his book tour. It is a great book. And you may have noticed, by the way, that we didn't have an advertiser today. Caleb, the producer, just explained to me that's because the way advertisers book or buy slots or whatever, there's a lag time. And so like 6 weeks ago or a month ago, when they would have been buying for these slots, was at the heart of the pandemic panic. And no one knew how to advertise or if they should advertise, so they just pulled all their ads. And it's actually kind of, when you think about it, it's a neat illustration of the lag effect of so much of the pandemic stuff. You know, the data on hospitalizations and deaths and new cases and all that kind of stuff, it's kind of like the light you see from a star. You know, the light that hits your eye now left that star, you know, tens of thousands or millions of years ago, depending on how far away it is. The data that we get today on all these websites tracking stuff is from 2 weeks ago in terms of what the facts on the ground are. And the same thing goes for advertisements on this podcast. Anyway, just a rambling thing. Speaking of advertising, if you decide to buy Matt Ridley's book, which I really recommend that you do, it would be great for us if you would go on Twitter and say, you know, hey, I just bought Matt Ridley's book because I heard him on The Remnant, and use our Twitter handle, which is @JonahRemnant. Twitter, by the way, is just an unbelievable cesspool for me for the last couple of days because I dared criticize Kayleigh McEnany or whatever her name is, the White House press secretary. And I guess I had not fully appreciated that she is the new it girl of MAGA world. And not that it changes my opinion at all, but it has been a fire hose of sewage. Has turned me pretty sour on Twitter. These things happen. Kind of reminds me of some other episodes that I've been through. But anyway, one must persevere. So anyway, if you can give a plug to The Remnant, about our advertisers, about our guests, that's all good for us. We only do it if it's true, but it would be helpful for us, and it helps us promote, helps us get guests like Matt Ridley back on. And I guess that's all I've got. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.